traditional medicine, what it does is it waits till you're drowning. Then it puts a Band-Aid on the issue, but doesn't do root cause, like go up, like, why are people drowning? Why are people getting thrown in? And that just putting Band-Aids on things like an SSRI, instead of going to the root cause of they're disconnected or they're not sleeping well or whatever it is, like, that's a big difference. And it all comes down to incentives, like you mentioned. Like, there's no pharmaceutical company, there's no big PR firm or marketing group pushing connection and sleeping better. Like, it's nobody's making money from that, and so they're not talking about it.
What is happening? Welcome back to your favorite podcast, the Gord Eye Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Mahaley, and I am thrilled to have you back on another journey with us. Before the show begins, if you please could hit the subscribe button, share this with your friends if you love the show, and check out the sponsors in the show notes. It would help this show grow tremendously. Get ready. There is a mind-blowing episode coming. I'll see you inside. Dr. Matt Dawson, you and Dr. Mike Mallon founded Wild Health 6 years ago. And Wild Health, it's really cool. You guys are sort of transforming healthcare through this precise approach to maximizing health span. Really freaking cool. Something that I guess as I turn 30, I start like seeing some gray hairs and like a little bit of a receding hairline going on. So maximizing the value of my longevity is of high importance to me. But 6 years ago, Matt, nobody was talking about this stuff yet. You were a little bit ahead of schedule, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was about 6 years ago, both of us were in traditional medicine, seeing that it wasn't working. And we noticed all of this evidence coming out about genomics, personalized medicine. But like you say, no one was actually doing it. And that's medicine's usually like 15 years behind. And this science was just a few years old. And so you're totally right. We did it because it was something that we would want, something that we wanted. We're getting older as well. Like you mentioned, you're in your 30s. I'm 74.
Oh, my God.
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, shit. I was going to say, what? Yeah, if you're not watching on YouTube right now, everyone watching on YouTube was just floored. Yeah. I was like, bro,
I should have rolled with
you. Look like my age.
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. I'm 42. But we had seen this in medicine that it's always kind of 15 years behind. And we were kind of blown away by the science because we were like, you know, we've been talking about personalized medicine for years with the Human Genome Project and all that. And it's here. It looked like it was here. And so we dove in, we sequenced our own genome, started looking at that. Around that time, Mike had a pretty difficult issue, like with his health. He found out his cholesterol was through the roof. It wasn't like a little elevated, like people overreact to, but really kind of dangerous levels. His doctor told him to do a specific diet. He got worse. His lipids got worse. His doctor wanted to put him on a statin. We were a little worried, like muscle breakdown, myopathy from that, but they were so high, not coming down. He did it. Sure enough, he got that muscle breakdown, myopathy. And at the time we're competing too. We're like running ultra marathons, doing a lot of stuff. And it was very disruptive. And as he was going through this, we looked at our DNA and we saw a couple of things. One, he needed to be on almost the exact opposite diet his doctor put him on. Two, he had this single nucleotide polymorphism that made him almost guaranteed to get that muscle breakdown. And we kind of were angry. We're like, why did his doctor not know this? Why did he have to go through this and suffer? And then we were like, yeah, that's right. Nobody's doing it. Like, somebody needs to start doing this. And that's when we kind of went for it and started doing it for friends, family, other doctors, and kind of snowballed from there.
What does genomics entail?
So what we do with every patient is we start out by sequencing your DNA. That's kind of like your human operating system. It's crazy to me that any doctor would treat you without knowing your operating system. However, that's only about 20% of your health outcome. The other 80% is epigenetics and your lifestyle, everything you do, what you eat, how you work out, how you sleep, your stress levels, what you're exposed to. So we also do a really deep dive into your blood work to see where are you now. So we've got your potential with the DNA, the genomics, and your risk factors, what your advantages, disadvantages are. And then we also look at where are you now with your vitamins, minerals, nutrients, hormones, everything that makes you feel and perform a certain way. And then we bring all of that together with a conversation to make it very personalized. What are your goals? To come up with the precision recommendations, like what's the perfect diet? What are the perfect foods? What foods are going to be your kryptonite versus superfoods? How to optimize your sleep? So that's what the genomics is. It's personalizing it to you based on your DNA and what will work for you.
Dr. Matt, what foods do you find to be quite universal in terms of helping people? What I'm thinking of is like blueberries, avocado. If you don't have an allergy to salmon or seafood, like these are pretty beneficial to most, right?
Yeah, that's right. I would say, so this is one of the big aha moments for Mike and I when we looked at our DNA to start. We saw, like I mentioned, he had this DNA that was very sensitive to saturated fats, for example, whereas I had none of that. And we looked at multiple different things, and what we found is like, wow, like he needs to be almost on a vegan type diet. And I, on the other hand, do great, like ketogenic, like tons of animal proteins. So we were just so different. We did some really fun experiments then. We would spend like 2 weeks where we would eat his diet for 2 weeks, check our blood levels before and after, do all the same workouts. He would destroy me when we were on his diet, flip it around. We would eat the ketogenic diet, tons of animal proteins. He would feel like crap. His inflammatory markers would go through the roof and I would destroy him. So this is this aha moment of like, I used to not like to talk about nutrition because it felt like religious wars. People were like carnivore, vegan, all these things. And I'm like, come on. And I realized there's a good reason for that. People find the diet that works best for them and they think this is the perfect human diet. And so they turn into evangelists for it. We're just so unique. I feel like I'm dodging your question though. So to get specific to your question, certainly. Like, I mean, I think if we went to just basics, we could think about Michael Pollan and the Omnivore's Dilemma. He says, eat foods, not too much. And then he says, mostly plants. I would say that depends on kind of the person as well. But whole foods is the basics. Mike and I are different. Like I said, like for me, and this is gets into the personalization for us. Just give you one example of this, the perfect food for me. So I have a VDR SNP, meaning I need more vitamin D. I have a BCMO, meaning I need more vitamin A. A FADS2, meaning I need more active omega-3, and a collagen 5A1, meaning I need more collagen protein. So you put those together, and the world's perfect food for me is sardines, a clean fish with the omega-3, the collagen protein, the bones, the vitamin D and the vitamin A, and the little organs, because it's a whole animal. And that's like the perfect food for me. Mike would be a little different, and everybody's a little bit different. But as far as a basic level goes, it's the things that we know. It's like whole foods as much as possible and not junk food. I think there can be animal junk foods, factory farmed animals, and junk plants, like these monocrop plants. So just whole foods as close to as wild as you can get.
This is not going to be your area of expertise. I'm just wondering if you know anything about it. I have a guy coming on the show in a few weeks. We're talking about the American meat system and what's going on there. Last week, he mentioned to me that there was some sort of legislature passed that inhibited manufacturers from being able to call meat that's not made in America, like USA or USD, whatever the case may be, because you know they're bringing meat from New Zealand, Australia, you know, China, other places to America, and as long as it gets repackaged or cut or something in America, then it's like made in America meat. I'm not sure if you saw that, just something kind of cool that happened that's going to be changing. And we are apparently, not sure how much I trust anything going on in the FDA, but we are apparently going to be getting more transparency as far as our meat production goes. Now, let me ask you, everyone has these different diets that are going to work best for them based off of their genomic sequencing. Is there anyone that does really well on high glycemic carbs? Like it comes back and you're just like, man, you know what? You need to eat more jasmine rice and things like that. Or do you not see that often?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for like the beer and pizza person. For that. I haven't found it yet. As many people as hope that that's theirs. So no, not like high glycemic. Now, having said that, like we take care of One of the first patients we took care of was my grandmother, who had Alzheimer's disease, and we optimized and had great results with her. And then we take care of pro athletes, like NBA max contract guys, Olympic athletes. And so for our athletes, we certainly have folks to use those two examples, my grandmother really needed to be on a very ketogenic diet, get ketones in the brain for that Alzheimer's, almost like as few carbohydrates as possible. Whereas our pro athletes, they need a lot of carbohydrates for recovery and performance. So when it comes to the perfect diet, I have not seen anybody that needs a lot more like high glycemic carbs for sure. But we definitely have folks that were just like cramming the calories in, but that's a very special circumstance, is burning 4,000 calories a day in the pool or something like that.
I was an athlete at the University of Cincinnati, and I was just a track athlete, nothing very cool, but the basketball team, men's basketball team, had a sponsorship with BW3, the Buffalo Wild Wings, and they were able to go in there every single day. And whatever they wanted to eat, it was free. As long as it was for them, they just like can't like get their friends comped. And these guys are going in eating 30 chicken wings and 8 cheese sticks and, you know, flatbread pizza or whatever. But they're playing basketball all day long, that their bodies are just such machines that, yeah, like you're alluding to, 4,000 calories in the pool, 6,000 calories in the pool. I mean, for some of these guys, that's nothing. That being said, a lot of my current work is done in bodybuilding. I am wildly contrarian in that realm, because I'm like, hey, you know what? You can build muscle eating more veggies and fruits and watching where your protein is sourced from and having low stress or just the right amount of stress versus low stress, I think is a better way to put it. Because in the bodybuilding realm, I mean, Matt, people are just, they're overeating. They're overeating. In an off season for bodybuilding, how most people do it, they're type 2 diabetics.
Yeah.
I don't believe in that. I'm in my athlete results prove that you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
You're a bodybuilder. Let's say you do have to eat a lot of carbohydrates. You're big movers for bodybuilding. I want to have a dialogue on this rather than just throw you on the spot, because I have some stuff that I want to, I'll start with and then you add to it. Big movers off season. They don't get too fat. If you're too fat, then you're literally type 2 diabetic. If you're too fat in the off season as a bodybuilder, eating that much food. Sunlight exposure is just absolutely, that's the universe's magic that we can get and take advantage of every single day. Having a high of a VO2 max as you possibly can as a hypermuscular individual, I think is going to be really beneficial for us. I use more HIIT cardio than I think anybody else does, just to be able to get that anaerobic and aerobic conditioning really firing hard. I think prioritizing recovery, and I think most bodybuilders are in a habitual overtrained state, which is why I think that they need as much food as they do or as much drugs as they do. I want to start there and then toss it to you. What would you add to that to keep bodybuilders healthier than what they are right now?
Yeah, so you make a great point. You're talking about the basketball players. So I played a couple sports in college, and I remember I could eat anything, yep, and like it's fine. You're just like, if the engine is hot enough, you burn whatever. The problem is that's tricky. It may not actually have a big detrimental effect on your performance. Then the issue is going to be 20, 30 years down the road. So when I quit playing, obviously I blew up, gained 25 pounds, mm-hmm, lost that. And then now I'm kind of more in a building phase. I did some endurance stuff, which is not great long-term for most people. But to your point in question, we've seen this in pro athletes a lot. So I've got past professional cyclists, for example, who would pound stuff and they didn't care, just get the calories in. They're thinking that the quality didn't matter. And it didn't matter that much for their performance. But what we find then is we do CT angiograms and they've got all this plaque buildup.
What's that? And
so the number one thing that most likely to kill you and I is cardiovascular disease, yep, as Americans. And the way you have a heart attack, stroke, is from clotting in your arteries, either in your brain with a stroke or your coronary arteries. And so when anyone over kind of 40, we're doing big workups with the genetics and the biomarkers, but also doing AI, clearly cardiac CTA scans to look at their vessels. And so we'll find these young in their 40s, shouldn't have any buildup, prior athletes, but how dirty the foods they were eating combined with the inflammatory response of the chronic training, they get this buildup and the risk for heart attacks and strokes and things later. So it's thinking about when we talk to athletes or young folks like this, like or bodybuilders you're talking about. Yeah, let's they're focused on the performance now, but it's kind of my job to think about you 30 years down the road. So the quality of what you're eating and those carbs and calories are critically important now for future you.
Got it. I cut you off when you were talking about some things, maybe bodybuilders or like the cyclists. I love that you bring up the cyclists. I think that's a Olympic equivalent to what bodybuilding would be, or maybe like Olympic weightlifting. Are there any big movers you see that like, man, if you guys really nailed this, like this could help us tremendously outside of the whole foods, of course. And you also brought up inflammation from training. I would love for you to chat about that as well.
Sure. I think the biggest mover is sleep. I mean, we see this constantly. Like there's a great study out of Stanford. They looked at the basketball players, bringing them back, college athletes, and they randomized the players to getting a certain amount of sleep, like a good amount of sleep, or just doing what college kids do. Mm-hmm. And the difference in their free throw shooting and 3-point percent shooting was 9% different.
My group God, that's
their
huge.
Sleep times were better. Their mood was better, and it just affected everything. I'll give you one quick story about that. An NBA player, again, this is a max contract guy, came to us for mood issues throughout the season. So obviously, that's going to affect his performance. Mm-hmm. So he's depressed. Obviously, we did not go to just putting him an SSRI or anything like normal medicine would. We dug in, and what we found, and this is a great example of how different genes and lifestyle make an impact. He was doing the same thing that all the other players on the team were doing, which is pounding Red Bulls caffeines before the game. And because we've known for decades that caffeine is an ergogenic aid, makes you perform better. However, when you look at those studies, caffeine is an ergogenic aid for 80% of people. And then when you break down genetics, about 80% of people are fast metabolizers. So when you study the different genetics, the fast metabolizers perform better. The slow metabolizers, it hurts their performance actually. So he was a slow metabolizer, and he had another genetic SNP called a DORA 2A that made caffeine more negatively affect his sleep than it would most people. So he was hurting his performance, destroying his sleep. He'd get to sleep at 4 a.m, get up just in time for shoot around, go back to sleep, get up for the game. It's a vicious cycle. And when we just corrected that, matched his lifestyle to his genetics with the sleep, he had the best year of his career. He was in talks to win MVP. Like that sleep, if you can optimize an athlete's sleep, everything gets easier. Less injury, less chance of injury, make better decisions around food, workouts more intense, just everything.
Beautiful. I pulled that study up. It's quite fascinating. Of course, I'm trying to read a little bit to pull some snippets out while I'm keeping up with the fascinating stuff you're sharing here. For anyone who wants to reference that, PMID 21731144 on NCBI. I mean, I very briefly read through this and my God, that's crazy stuff. 9.2% 3-point field goal percentage, 9% free throw percentage. That is literally the difference of winning a conference championship and being out in the first round. That's the difference between like the Elite Eight and not making the tournament. And like if a whole team is doing that, that's seismic. Natural versus synthetic caffeine. I ruffled some feathers on this with a recent episode with a neuroscientist that I had on, Dr. Allison Berger. She is fascinating, soon to be astronaut as well. And we talked about how synthetic caffeine just rushes your brain and like drops this bomb of energy on it. And you know, natural caffeine, like from coffee or from tea, has more natural minerals with it that help delay the absorption or make the absorption more mild in nature, and they come down a little bit better. Do you disagree with that? Do you have anything that you want to add to that? People on Instagram are really angry with me for suggesting that monsters are worse than coffee for you.
So I would love to see that data because that sounds fascinating. I haven't seen like the kinetic bioavailability and curves of different types of caffeine. So that's really cool. It makes sense because if you're going to design something and you want to be addictive, it's about the speed of hit more than anything else, that velocity. So that totally makes sense. But yeah, I'd love to see that data. That sounds really
interesting. Remind me after this show, and I can send you over Dr. Berger's work on it. Absolutely fascinating. You said that I want to go back to this. Caffeine only, this isn't what you said, these are my words, works in about 80% of people the way that we want it to. that's not a lot of people, considering if every 10 caffeine users, eight are two of them are using it incorrectly. That's a massive situation. Their body's using it incorrectly. What's that manifest like? What are some things they experience?
Yeah, and I'll clarify and refine that a little bit. It's not that it only works in HP. So everybody is going to, caffeine is an adenosine antagonist. It keeps you up. Adenosine is what makes you sleepy. It's hormone that makes you sleepy. So it blocks those and it keeps you up. So it works for everyone, quote unquote works. Okay. If you're not watching me there, and like keeping you up and alertness. The pointed question was, is it an ergogenic aid? Does it make you perform better athletically?
Got it.
So that's where the difference is. So, and the studies on this were in a 10K time trial cyclists is where they did the best studies on this. There's been studies at multiple other sports. But what they found is there's three different types of caffeine metabolizers: fast, moderate, and slow. If you're a fast metabolizer, they found a big improvement with caffeine just before this time trial because of the way you process it. If you're a moderate caffeine metabolizer, no change either way. And if you're a slow metabolizer, it hurts your performance to have caffeine. Also, if you're a slow metabolizer, it's going to have a bigger impact on your sleep by definition, because you're going to have more in your system at night when you go to sleep. And so just knowing that, if someone is a fast metabolizer and an athlete, I say, absolutely, have some caffeine before you work out. We know you're going to perform better. If they're a slow metabolizer, absolutely don't. And if they're moderate, we can play with it and see how do you feel and be a little more subjective about it.
Fascinating. I believe caffeine's onset time is usually like 35, 45 minutes in a normal person. I have to be a fast metabolizer. I feel it quite quickly. 10, 15 minutes maybe. Is that a placebo, or would that be in line with being a fast metabolizer?
So we could, I think we have your genetics. Part of the report, so we could easily take a look and see exactly what you are. But you're right. The normal time is kind of 30 to 45 minutes of the time of onset. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. And it hurts performance. Of course, this is done in athletic studies, but one could imagine for the people who are not athletes listening to the show, one could imagine it would hurt like mental cognition as well.
Yeah. They're not great studies on that, but we extrapolate everything. We like my grandmother who had Alzheimer's versus our pro athletes. We think about performance as performance. It's just whether or not you're competing for a world championship or whether or not you're trying to be able to dance at your great granddaughter's wedding.
Dude, like, I love that.
Performance is performance.
I love how you say that. Yeah, we need to have a more universal thought to performance, because people will hear this, or they'll hear what Dr. Berger talks about, or they'll hear some of the things I'll talk about, and they're like, well, I'm not an athlete. Like, dude, everyone's an athlete. If you're moving, you're an athlete. And if you're not an athlete, you're probably over fat, or I call them hypercalorie. You're probably hypercalorie and under muscled if you're not, like, you should be an athlete. Realistically, I guess, I think your entire life, speaking from a 30-year-old that's only ever been an athlete, it's probably like a luxury belief to think that. But I mean, shouldn't you be 60 and be able to like pick up a run, pick up a little jog?
Of course. Like, I mean, you said it perfectly. Like, we are born athletes. We are athletes. Like, when we move, like, everyone has a different kind of, it's semantics, their definition of that, but everyone should be striving to, it doesn't mean you have to run or you have to do a certain thing, but everyone wants to be mobile. That's part of being human, is just being mobile and being able to do what you want physically.
Freaking semantic culture. You are so right. People will just, they need a definition for everything, an exact definition for just move and like push your body a little bit. I want to run a belief system I have by you. As a doctor who is helping keep people young, vital for their life, I have this thing where I just say every day, if you go to the gym and you have a physical output that is really pushing your body, really pushing your mental, really pushing your physical, and you make that the absolute hardest part of your day, and you do that every single day, that emotional taxations and adversity quotients and things of the like are going to be much easier for you to simply manage. Some people dislike that. I just simply think if you push your body physically every day, that you can literally guarantee growth in so many different areas. What would you say to that?
Yeah, you have, we are meant to be uncomfortable, and we live in a society where we don't have to be. We can go through the entire day being comfortable the entire day, but that uncomfortableness, pushing through that pain leads to, I like where you're going with that, not just the kind of physical performance gains, but mentally as well. Just doing hard things, like we're able to do hard things, and we need to see that. We need to prove that to ourselves, and it makes a big difference in the rest of our lives. I work out every day. I'm not trying to compete in anything anymore. But if I didn't, I know my mental health suffers massively. I do it more for that than anything else. It just optimizes the rest of my day. So moving is important, but getting uncomfortable with the movement is critical in my mind. We have to push ourselves and do that little bit of stress, that hormetic stress to get stronger.
I want to bring three components of this show so far together. I personally don't know. There's no research done on this because I think it'd be impossible to standardize this. I don't know a single person, doctor, that gets out in the sun every single day, that does something really hard physically every single day, and that prioritizes sleep every single day, that has depression. That's like sad.
No. And you look at like how we think about and treat depression now with SSRIs and medications. And there's just really good studies showing, for example, just the one component of that, exercise. Exercise is better head to head than an SSRI medication. So then when you stack those, and I would add one more to that, I think most of our dis-ease in the US and developed worlds is related to disconnection. And what I mean by that is a disconnection from ourselves, from our bodies. So the movement part, from our food, we have no idea where that comes from nature, the sunlight, like you mentioned, and then a disconnection from other people too. So what you just mentioned is beautiful, but I try to stack all of that together. So for example, a lot of mornings, as many as I can, I'll have people from our company come to my house. I live in the woods on a couple hundred acres, and we'll go hiking together, rucking. And depending on your fitness level, how much weight you put in your backpack. And so we're connecting to our bodies, to nature, that movement, and to each other. And that, when you talk about mental health and depression, is the antidote in my mind.
Let's uncover through a little bit of a deeper discussion so people will hear this and be like, okay, I know all of this. What do I do? I know I need to get in the sun. I know I need to move. I know I need to eat well. I know I need to. Some people just really struggle with drive, desire, obviously. If men are struggling with drive, I'm sure looking at their testosterone would be a great place to start. But you can't just pop everyone on some testosterone and like wait for the drive to come back. If you're not feeling the drive, like, where do you really start? Do you have to like practice discipline and still just through your eyes, just hypothetically thinking?
Yeah, I always say start where you can. So I think, we talk about discipline a lot, which I think is important. I think there's a difference in discipline and devotion too. Find some things you enjoy doing that are small steps towards that. Going for a walk out, let's say this is a busy person. They just think they don't have time for anything. Something small, like during the day, one or two of your work calls, take it outside while you're walking, just outside and walking.
Walk That's meetings. There's data on that now, doctor. Have you seen that? Data on the walk meetings.
I'm not sure if I'm thinking of specific data, but I think it's one of those things that like, I feel like once you do it, you realize, yes. Wow, why have I not been
doing this? It's right? Like 32% increase in cognition and perform. Dude, it's insane. I'm going to see if I can pull it up while you continue.
Yeah. Well, Mike and I, the co-founder of Wild Health, we have a joke. Like, we've never had a good idea when we're not running or doing something intense. And we'll frequently call each other and we'd be completely out of breath. And the other one would be like, sweet, here's a good idea. Yeah.
It's connection to what you said. That's connecting with yourself. It's not being stimulated. It's you're connecting to yourself. And that's where your ideas come from.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But as I was saying, kind of just what you can do, like finding something first, like discipline is a beautiful thing. But if you can start with something you enjoy doing, that it's more about devotion, then it starts to get easier to build and stack those things and then have the discipline to do the hard things as well. I don't think you have to do all. I think anybody that tries to do all of these things we're talking about all at once is kind of setting themselves up for failure. But stacking them one at a time and doing it with someone else, I think that's just so critical and so helpful to the process, for the accountability, finding someone to do it with you is going to be so important.
So this isn't the exact one I'm alluding to. It's just another one. The first one that I found, Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, correlated with walk meetings, being away from Zoom, being connecting, correlated with increased productivity, decreased work time, work time missed due to health reasons, decreased impairment while working, significantly correlated with positive mood, significantly affected worker mood, productivity, and increased occupational and physical activity levels. Just by simply getting away from their desk, and they're just going for normal walks. They're not even going for brisk walks. Meeting groups of 2 to 3 people. I mean, yeah, I think that's absolutely fascinating. It makes tons of sense. So I love that note because you're getting work done, you're walking, and you're getting sun. Hopefully you're getting sunlight. But also if you're walking in nature, like if you're walking in downtown, like in a bustling city, I'm not sure how much there's going to be, but it, like if you're connecting with nature, oh my goodness, it's insane. There's a question I wrote down earlier that I wanted to ask you about the importance of your epigenetics. So like your habits, your lifestyle versus the genes that you're born with as it pertains to longevity. And I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about telomere stuff here because, I mean, it's not that you can lengthen your telomeres, but can you delay how quickly they're getting shorter if you're already a really healthy person?
Yeah, so great question. So when we think about disease risk and mortality and things like that, your DNA is not your destiny. It's just not. Like, I think a lot of people, I'll give you a quick patient example, and then we'll talk about the kind of telomere-related things. I mentioned my grandmother with dementia. So one of my first patients I saw was my mother. I was very worried about her genetics. And when I sequenced her genetics, sure enough, she had this APOE4 gene that she inherited from my grandmother that put her 3 times increased risk for developing Alzheimer's and dementia. But when I talked to her about this, it was not bad news. What I said is, Mom, this is great. We know what you're at risk for now, and you're not going to get this because we know everything to do. And sure enough, we put her on the perfect diet, actually all the stuff that we do. And in 3 months, she lost 40 pounds, reversed her insulin resistance, and said she felt 20 years younger. And I truly believe that she's not going to get this disease because your DNA is not your destiny. You can do so much about it. And in fact, there's good studies on DNA and genetics is about 20% of the outcome. The other 80% is the epigenetics and all of that. Now, your question about telomeres, so that we have much better, so we've known about telomeres for a long time. However, we have much better measures now. So when I talk about those epigenetics, we actually measure epigenetics too through what's called DNA methylation. So we'll look at 950,000 CpG sites to see all of your genes, how much they're turned up or turned down. And that can tell us about an incredible amount of information. So there's a company called True Diagnostic that we use for this. And I think they have the coolest science that I have seen. So from that data, we can tell, everybody knows about these biologic age tests. And in the past, I've been not that excited about them because like if you're chronologically 40, but you're biologically 36 or 44, whatever, I'm going to try to optimize you either way. A cool test they have is called the PACE test. This was developed by Duke. It's called the Dunedin PACE test. And what it does is it tells you a rate of aging. And the great thing about this is it's been shown to be sensitive to intervention. So if you get pregnant, your rate of aging goes up 20%. And then when you deliver the baby, it comes back down. If you get COVID, if you're in a car accident, hip surgery, the rate of aging goes up, then it comes back down when you recover. So what that allows me to do is to do N of one experiments. So there was a study out of Stanford, a twin study, not a great study actually, but what they did in that study was they randomized, they had these twins either an omnivore or a vegan diet, and they measured a bunch of measures. And they did find that over 8 weeks, this rate of aging test went up or down. Mm-hmm. So now I can tell someone like, hey, we think vegan or a carnivore or omnivore diet is going to be best for you, but let's test your rate of aging before and at 2 weeks. Or someone says, I want to try this new senolytic medication. Or someone all the time, people say, I want to go fly to Panama and do IV stem cells. Well, it costs 40, 50 grand. And so instead of me saying, studies show it works, which when I say that, it means studies show it works for most people or it doesn't. I want to know what does work for you. So I say, great, let's do the PACE test, see what your rate of aging is. Do the intervention, 2 months, we're going to check it again and see how it affects your biology. And by doing that, we can actually stack the interventions to find the things that are decelerating your aging the most. So that is the real test of the telomeres, is that rate of aging test.
That is so cool. I've never heard of it. I looked it up while you're speaking on it. It sounds absolutely fascinating. But my next question then would be, man, we're asking people to track a lot of biomarkers, a lot of delicate health numbers, and it can feel really foreign to people. Mm-hmm. Outside of these tests, blood work, and maybe a GI map to make sure that our gut's good, as we know how important that is, maybe a PACE test, what Wild Health does, which is absolutely fantastic to prevent against chronic disease and things of the like. What are some key metrics that maybe on a basal level we can start with? If we're talking to someone who's at zero, someone who's scared to have the answer, which I think a lot of people are scared to have the answer, what can we start tracking? I would assume hormones are really freaking important. I think they are, at least. Yep. And then how can we kind of build upon that to get the more complex items down and defeat that fear of knowing?
Sure. So I feel like I sound like a broken record saying it's all personalized, but let me give you some examples of why, and then I'll get very specific with some tests. Mm-hmm. So like what we do is we look at millions of data points, but we have an AI platform that's able to ingest all that and make sense of it and give precision recommendations. People, if you're not a patient of ours, you can't do that. So let's break it down for others. If your goal is immediate performance now, then what I'm going to be thinking about is, on a blood test, your hormones. That's going to be critical. Your vitamin D is going to be really important because that's actually been shown to affect athletic performance. Maybe your omega-3s as well, because inflammatory effects and how well you recover. So those are some basic things for performance. But more importantly for performance is going to be day-to-day measuring. So your fitness trackers. So like your sleep and your HRV. HRV is a great one where you never have to get any blood tests. You're tracking that daily and weekly and seeing those trends. That's going to have a big impact on your performance. So that's just performance, like right now. Those are some things. Now, if you tell me your risk is like, I don't care about that. I'm not trying to compete in anything. I just want to be as healthy as long as I can, maximizing health span. Well, then I want all of the information. I want all the DNA to see your risk factors and all that. But if I don't have all of that and it's just you're tracking, there's some very basic things. I mentioned the big killers, so cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, those types of things. So I'm thinking about those. So with those, it's really metabolic health is the number one thing. So and we have a lot of different measures for that. But if I was going to pick one, I would say just your hemoglobin A1C. It's not like a perfect measure over time, but that's going to, if you just had one, go after that. For cardiovascular disease, we know that a couple big drivers of that, to have a heart attack or stroke and to build up that plaque, it takes elevated lipids, like the bad lipids, and it takes inflammation and it takes endothelial damage. So the way I'd measure those two is look at your inflammatory markers like CRP and homocysteine, and then your lipids. If your lipids is complicated, as a whole field of lipidology, but if you're going to get one, it's just ApoB. Just try to push that ApoB down as much as you can. Now, having said that,
can you chat a little bit real quick about ApoB?
Sure. It's just, so if you get an NMR complex lipopan, you're going to get LDL, LDLC, LDLP, like all these different measures, LP little a, people talk about ApoB. So not to get into like an hour long lipidology talk, ApoB is the one that's been shown to kind of be most correlated with having lipids that are going to cause problems. So if you just want to remember one simple metric, it would be have your doctor get an ApoB. That's the one you can follow without understanding all the other stuff. So it's just a good marker for that. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I'm not going to automatically treat a high ApoB. So when I have a patient and we're talking about cardiovascular disease, the reason I'm worried about high ApoB is because if you have it floating around for a long time and you get inflammation and other things, which everybody does have spikes of these, you start to build up plaque in your arteries, which eventually leads to that heart attack or stroke or dementia. So now when I have a patient that has elevated lipids, I don't go immediately to a medication for it. I will look at, are we actually having that end organ damage? So that's when we'll go to kind of the CT angiogram. So for someone over 30s, especially over 40s, high cholesterol, we may try just dietary things first to improve it. If we can't, before I go to medication, I want to do that that CT scan. I have a 60-something-year-old right now, for example, is really elevated lipids. But we did the scan and she's got no calcium because she runs 5 miles a day. It's a beautiful diet and she takes care of it all with epigenetics. So she's not laying that down. So since she's not having that end organ damage, I'm not as worried about those lipids. So it's a complicated picture, but I'll try to give you a couple that people could track. The ApoB, hemoglobin A1C, those are kind of probably the two biggest for long-term maximizing health span.
Yeah, perfect. You brought up the calcification. Obviously, we start having that occur and just drives the risk of cardiovascular issues. Really drives the risk of all issues. Because if your heart can't pump, if your cardiovascular system can't pump blood around your body without being really stressed, your brain gets stressed, musculoskeletal system gets stressed, everything gets stressed. You're listening to this podcast. You're like, all right, I'm going to go get a test done. Comes back, calcium's pretty high. We have calcification going on. What do you do at that point? How do you reverse that? Yeah. Fix that? Can you?
So the standard wisdom in the past has been that you can't really reverse it. You just want to slow the buildup down. However, we've seen some reversals and people who really focus on it, but that's not the norm. Mm-hmm. And I would say, just to say one thing about that too, though, you can get a calcium score. I've been talking about calcium. The best test, there's a company called Clearly, C-L-E-E-R-L-Y. That's who we use. They do the scan, but they apply some AI software to it to really tell the difference in hard and soft plaques and give you a better risk stratification. So if someone's going to do it on their own, I think that's the best test. But depending on how bad it is what we do. We would probably start, if it's not horrible, with just saying, here, we're going to optimize your lifestyle, your exercise routine, your diet, your sleep, and then we're going to rescan in a couple of years. If you're getting no progression or getting better, we don't need any medications. Forget it. Like, we'll see what that velocity of change is. However, if it's really bad or we get it and then it's worsening over a couple of years, then certainly we'll go to medications. So if we need to reduce your cholesterol, statins, they can work. We look at your genetics to make sure that you don't have a genetics that you're probably going to respond poorly to them. But frequently now we're actually going straight to a drug called Repatha, mm-hmm. which is a once every other week injection. And it just works really well and has less side effects than the statin. The issue with it is just more expensive.
Earlier in the podcast, you said that you and Dr. Mike Mallon just didn't really like what was going on in traditional medicine before you founded Wild Health. Mm-hmm. I challenge a lot of things in traditional medicine, not because I'm a doctor, because I'm unbelievably curious. Well, my entire adult life has been spent helping other people in physical fitness. Bodybuilding is obviously very intricate, and some of the lessons you get to learn in bodybuilding is pretty cool. It's a unique skill set. For example, the other day I made a post on Instagram. This one pissed some people off, and most doctors who comment on it really agreed with it. I said, if you are being prescribed SSRIs before there's a gut health check, you have a drug dealer, not a doctor. People didn't like that last part. That's my belief system, though. That's what I believe. It goes back to the point about, okay, you're getting sunlight, you're getting physical activity, you have community, you have togetherness, you have connection with yourself, to nature, to other people, then you're probably going to be all right. But if you have all those things and you're still not, then I'm going straight to your gut. I mean, the gut-brain axis is like a real thing, and people are really far behind on that. One, tear me apart if you absolutely hate that. I give you the floor for that. But then I want you to dive into what's wrong with traditional medicine?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would go further than just the if you're not checking the gut, I would say if you haven't tried multiple other things before an SSRI, like they're just so ubiquitous. I mean, so many people are on them. Yeah. When you look back at the original literature, like when they were done, I don't think they would be approved anymore today. Like, they're not that much better than a placebo, tons of side effects.
15%, right? 15% is the work rate.
Oh, I thought you were going to say side effect rate. I think it's a lot higher than that.
No, like 15% of SSRIs actually help people or something.
Well, so the way we do studies and the way we compare is like to placebo. So when you look back at the O studies, like, you give anyone a pill who is depressed or anxious, they're actually about 20% or so will get better, but that's a placebo effect. So when I talk about effects too, it's like over placebo. So SSRIs just aren't that much better than placebo.
Placebo effects, 20%.
Placebo effect is a big effect, and it's a real effect. And
yeah.
Yeah, so we should lean into that frequently, but don't lean into it with something that's going to cause side effects. Like that's when I see people prescribe SSRIs, it's like, oh, it's a good chance it'll work, because you give them anything, it's a good chance it'll work. It's just, are we causing problems as well? I think the gut, the checking the gut, like you said, is great, but I'd say there's just so much more than that. I mean, you check vitamin D levels, the omega-3 levels, like are they working out? Like so many things you should fix before you go to an SSRI.
Yeah. Fascinating. I'm looking at some stuff here. This is just one of those things that's so tricky to nail down, because this one says 40%. This one says 25%. But I mean, the goal of SSRIs is basically to increase serotonin at the end of the day, right?
That's right. And the interesting thing is, like, we still, like, we call them SSRI selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. No one actually knows exactly how they work. We just noticed that they did work.
but we're throwing prescriptions around everybody.
Yeah. If anyone's interested, there's a good book. Speaking of the connection issue, which I talked about, I think it's Johan Hari is the name.
Lost Connections.
Exactly. Yeah. So he goes into that science pretty good for a layperson, if anybody was interested in
that. That book, it changed my life. So last week was, Matt, you know how it is. Some weeks you're just struggling. Some weeks are just hard to be a human. And for last week, that was me. And it's like Friday, and I notice I've been struggling all week. I've not talked to anybody about it. I've not surrounded myself with anybody. I've completely isolated from everything to just like mull down into my workload. I haven't had any sort of external communication. I just tell everyone when they ask how I'm doing, I say, okay. And I'm like, oh, well, Lost Connections literally talks about exactly this. I call my best friend. Hey, what time you be done working today? Can we go grab lunch? And I'm like, he's like, is everything okay? And I'm like, no, actually, I'm struggling horrendously mentally. And I have been for about a week or two now. And I'm not very happy. And I'm not feeling good. So I just need some companionship. We go to lunch. We have a full conversation. I get to spill everything. And I have been so happy and so much better since. And number one, having an amazing friend group and an amazing best friend like that is obviously highly beneficial. But I mean, doctor, people just don't have community. People don't have community. Depression and anxiety don't exist in these little civilizations of 50 people that aren't even connected to the internet are the happiest people in the world. And they don't even have resources. They have to scavenge their own resources every single day. They're the happiest, most fulfilled people in the world. And we're out here just prescribing SSRIs to everybody. And the issue is like, it's the whole white lab coat theory. Well, if Dr. Matt tells me that I have this wrong, then it's wrong. And so you just separate from. A lot of athletes experience this. You break your wrist and you're out for 6 months, and your entire purpose in life is playing this sport, and you mentally start disconnecting from this wrist and this hand because it's immobile. You can't use it, and you find it to be worthless. And athletes go through this, and then all of a sudden the casket's taken off. You have to reconnect with it, but you haven't connected with it in 8 months because doctor told you, it's broken, keep it immobile, don't move it, yada, yada. And that's not the doctor's fault. That's the doctor doing their job. It's the human brain fault. The issue is when we do it with the human brain. And you go in and a doctor's like, oh, you're depressed. Oh, your brain's not acting right. And then you disconnect from that was from Lost Connections too. You disconnect from everything above your neck. And now you look in the mirror, you don't even know who you are. I could do an entire show on that. What I want to get into is what's wrong with traditional medicine then? Like, what you're doing is taking people to a true anti-aging disease prevention sort of level.
Yeah.
But traditional medicine is trying to get recurring customers as far as it looks to me.
Yeah. I mean, so I could talk about that, but in my personal experience, what I saw is, I spend most of my career in traditional medicine in the emergency department, which I love. Like, it's a lot of fun, like saving someone's life. Like, that's great.
That's very cool.
It is. Like somebody comes in, you put a breathing tube in, you save their life. Like you feel great. What I was noticed though, is I was seeing the same people and the same things. And it reminded me of this parable of this little village by a river, guys floating. They hear screams one day, they go out, someone's floating down the river, they pull them out, save their life. Great. Next day, same things happen. They hear screams again, they go to and pull somebody out. Happens again. And finally someone says, maybe we should walk upstream and see who's throwing people in the river instead of just pulling them out. And that's what I felt like. There's got to be a better way. There's something upstream that we could do. And by optimizing people, keep them from drowning per se. In traditional medicine, what it does is it waits till you're drowning. Then it puts a Band-Aid on the issue, but doesn't do root cause, like go up like, why are people drowning? Why are people getting thrown in? And that just putting Band-Aids on things like an SSRI, instead of going to the root cause of they're disconnected or they're not sleeping well or whatever it is, like that's a big difference. And it all comes down to incentives, like you mentioned. Like there's no pharmaceutical company, there's no big PR firm or marketing group pushing connection. It's nobody's making money from that. And so they're not talking about it. And it's
some of the happiest people I've ever seen are the 6 a.m. run club people.
Yeah.
I'll be walking my dog and there's all these run clubs around Austin. I mean, it's beautiful to see, but my God, no one's sat in that group. There's 100 people and you're all about to go for a run. I promise you're going to feel elated. AI and health. I'm fascinated. Absolutely fascinated. You guys are using some AI stuff to really go to the next level. For me, there hasn't been a ton of, there has been. There's a lot of benefit that I've gotten from AI. It can't really like look at a client's physique and assess exactly what they need in terms of their next bodybuilding diet or whatever the case may be. But my God, it seems like it's moving really fast in that direction. What do you think the next 5-10 years looks like of AI? And I mean, how far is this really going to go in this health span industry?
Yeah, it's going to be crazy. So I'll tell you how we're using it, because we've developed in partnership with an AI company that had partnerships with OpenAI and Microsoft before anybody ever heard of ChatGPT. So we've added a lot of generative AI, large language model stuff to what we do. So we developed a platform. We ingest millions of data points, the wearables, the DNA, blood work, all the stuff we've talked about, and gives precision recommendations. But the way it's delivered is with a doctor and a health coach. So when someone signs up for us, we do all the testing, run through the platform, and a doctor and health coach deliver that care. That's great. The problem is that's expensive. Like doctors and health coaches are expensive. The humans are expensive. And it's really bothered me. I grew up very poor, like where I grew up. Nobody could afford that level of care. Mm-hmm. So when I look at AI, what it's going to allow us to do is to democratize precision medicine. So what we've built, for example, we've already built large language models. We built our platform on large language models. So like we have, like for myself, I'm using this. It's not released yet. It's in beta, where all of my information, all my medical history, all these data points are on this AI. And just like you would chat with ChatGPT, ask it a question. So I can chat with this and say, what should I eat tonight for dinner? And knowing my genetics, like my HRV, like everything, it'll tell me the perfect thing. Give me a recipe. A couple weeks ago, I'd been sick for a little bit. It had been driving me nuts because I'd go to the gym. I'd lift, pick up some weights, and I'd like stare at them for a while and I couldn't do it. I was just there for 30 minutes picking up and putting down weights. I couldn't work out. And so I finally then started communicating with things like, I feel horrible, like looking at all my dad, like, what should I do? I was like, I got to do something just for my mental health. And it gave me like kind of a roadmap of things to do as I get better and we're adjusting each day. So the issue, so right now, the way we're using this is when a client sends a message, a question to the health coach or doctor, the large language model intercepts it, looks at everything and gives a recommended thought to the doctor and health coach to assist them. Then they can reject it, do something new, accept it, or modify it. So it's like people argue between like a doctor and AI. Well, no, we want like a centaur, like the combination of the two. Mm-hmm. That's how we use it now. But we want to release this into the wild to where people can, it can just be so much more affordable, like close to free. Like there's certainly some costs associated with it, but to where anyone could afford to have that level of recommendations personalized to them. We haven't yet because of regulatory reasons and AI can't practice medicine, but we're going to release a version of wellness only, which is lifestyle stuff, which is 80 to 90% of it anyway, like sleep, nutrition, exercise, no medication, no medical stuff, no diagnoses. But, and we'll roll that out for our patients first, probably in the next few months, a beta version to just our patients who want to try it. But that's what I'm excited about is taking all the things that we've learned in precision medicine genomics and democratizing it so everyone can afford it.
Absolutely nuts. You're saying these things and I'm not sure my brain can even comprehend how impactful that can be. So I appreciate that work as one wellness enthusiast that wants to see the entire world be healthy to another. I appreciate that work. RoboDoc, how far away are we from RoboDoc rolling in, looking at you, just, you know, what I envision is like a good doctor, but actually happening in real life and with a robot mind. And it just analyzes you and it can tell you everything that's wrong and it can make these recommendations. Of course, it's going to need a doctor's help because it can't practice medicine. But I mean, how far really are we from something like that? Is that crazy?
No, I would, how far we are, I'd say ask the FDA because it's a regulatory issue. It's not a technology issue. Like that exists. I mean, what we have now, like we've trialed this and looked at it. Like the recommendations, and there's multiple studies on this, like the recommendations that AI makes medically when given the information is better than most doctors. It just is. And even the bedside manner, there's a really cool study showing sending messages back and forth between AI and a regular doctor. And people actually felt the AI was even more compassionate and empathetic, which was a really interesting and crazy component. So how far we are from that is dependent more on regulatory than the technology. Like the quality of the large language models is getting so much better, so much more quickly on this scale that we can't comprehend that us as doctors, like, people will say, like, look, and they'll point at like mistakes that the LLM occasionally makes, these hallucinations, they call them other things. And they point to it as like, oh, this is not okay. In my mind, when I see those, I was like, do you know how many mistakes like regular doctors make and like people make? Like the little mistakes they have make is almost makes it, that's like the thing that makes it the most human in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
You
don't quite want it to be like too perfect right now. No one's life can be on the line, but like if it spells something wrong or it uses the wrong punctuation or it, you know, it might just simply miss a little tiny something. That's just not that huge of a deal. What's you and I's role going to be then when this happens? Why do you need a human doctor? Why do you need a personal trainer?
We've already talked about it. It's connection. It's like connection. It's love. It's the things that we as humans were born to do. It's not analyzing data. It's not giving like a better recommendation. It's connecting with people. Like I think the AI allows us to be more human and kind of offload some of the things that it does better. So I'm not scared of, I mean, I've talked about it. I'm not saying you're trying to replace physicians, but it sounded like I was saying that. Whether I was saying it or not, I'm not scared of it because I think the connection, the creativity, the love, those types of things is what humans should be doing with each other.
Man, I love that. That's really powerful. Doc, there's a lot of stuff that I feel like I've learned here in this episode. I was fired up to chat with you, and so far it's ended up being even better than really I thought. What's your mission? What does Wild Health, what do you guys want to achieve? When you set out and you wake up in the morning, what's your vision?
Yeah, our mission is very clear. It's to transform the lives of our patients. That's it. And so right now that's been through precision medicine and bringing this extremely high-tech thing to the masses. But as we do that, the things that we do will continue to evolve, whether it's with large language models or other things, but really, really want to have a transformative impact on people's lives and enable them to live the longest, healthiest life that they can and to help them find the reason for why. Like we talk a lot with our patients about why do you want to live forever and really help them visualize like their loved ones, the things that they love to do and living a long time out of love, not just a fear of death. So that's our goal, is really kind of transform the lives of our patients.
I got two questions left for you, and then we're going to get back to changing the world. Supplements are just overrated. The entire industry is absolute crap. I mean, what, we got 30%, like 30% of supplements aren't actually like honest in what they say. I've worked with companies before that Oh, that's interesting. You say that this isn't your product, but the blood work of all of my clients suggests that that was a lie. If you could have five supplements off the top, 3 to 5 supplements that you're like, you know what, most people are probably going to benefit from this. I'll start. Let me start since I put you on the spot. We're going 5, omega, magnesium complex, a B complex, a zinc complex. Complex is like a cop out. That's a cop out. I'm really getting more than 5.
Yeah.
That's 4. And, man, this probably won't be like the most popular thing to say, but I really like arginine. I think if you're promoting blood flow, to every single part of the body, that can only be highly beneficial. If it helps brain health and it helps sex health and it helps your heart, then that's really freaking beneficial. I'm probably the only person in the world that would put that in their top 5, but I'm a nut for sex health, and arginine is like a big deal for sex health. So I guess that's why I'm putting it there. I guess that would be my 5. It's also difficult because you left out caffeine. Like, I left out caffeine, and that's like a supplement. What would a top 5 look like for you?
Yeah, it's fun hearing your list. I can tell you work with bodybuilders and stuff. It's great. If you like arginine, it's like a substitute for kind of Cialis and Viagra for increased blood flow. Another one to think about there is cordyceps. So it's a mushroom. It's got a nickname of cordyceps because it also increases blood flow. It's good for performance from a general standpoint.
Is there a certain kind or just cordyceps?
Just cordyceps. I mean, I could get into the species of it. I'm a real mushroom and fungi nut, but if you just get a cordyceps product online, it's going to have that benefit. So my list would be a little different, just because I kind of general, just people in general is who I'm thinking about. And I have to say, like, when we talk to patients, it's extremely personalized. Like, I'm not going to just say omega-3 until I check your level. I ate 2 cans of sardines a day, so my omega-3 level is through the roof, so I don't take an omega supplement. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously personalized on testing, but if I had to just go across the board, absolutely, your omega-3, like you mentioned, the magnesium. Specifically, I love a magnesium L3 and 8 at night because of the sleep. We've talked about how critical sleep is, and it's really well absorbed and goes through the blood-brain barrier. So those are 2. The other 2 I'll throw in there is vitamin D. Of course, we would do testing for vitamin D, and I'd rather people get it from the sun. But if you're deficient in that, it's tough. And even if you have a good level, like even going from like 50 to 80, there's some performance benefits. And so then the last one I'll throw on, which is strange coming from me instead of you, is creatine.
Yeah.
So creatine, like, people think about it as like a bodybuilder thing and a bro thing, but it has really great mental and cognitive benefits. And I have had a really hard time finding anyone that I don't think the benefits outweigh the risk of creatine. So that's a pretty standard one
I mean, creatine is something I agree everybody should use. I guess in bodybuilding, it's like, well, when you're taking trenbolone, how much is creatine really doing?
Yeah. It's going to make a big difference to the grandma or somebody not eating meat. Loading up on.
Yeah. I'm blushing. I'm on the phone with a doctor talking about taking tren. What in the world has my life turned up to be? All right. The cordyceps for sex health is amazing. You gave me another question though. Typically in my clients, vitamin D levels, I like seeing in between 50 and 60. You like going up to that 80 range. You see a lot of benefit there.
So in general, we think of a below 30 as deficient, definitely want to get them up, and 56 is great. I think that's a great place to have people. There's some minor evidence that increasing vitamin D, you get better, stronger muscular contraction all the way up potentially to 80. Now everybody's different.
Yeah.
And these are like population level studies. So I'm not scared to push people up a little higher. We don't really know what happens over that, but your level 50 to 60, I think is going to get you 95% of the way there.
Yeah.
And it's easy enough to get people there. It's kind of hard to push a little higher than that. You got to start taking
dose. Cool. Beautiful. That's really good to know. I'm going to start working some people, maybe up that range, just get feedback, kind of see what's going on. Okay. Number one, before the last question, people, if you've listened to this podcast and you've gotten nothing out of it, then you knew way more than I knew coming into this podcast, and maybe you should take my job. But Wild Health, you absolutely got to hit them up. I sent my swab in a few weeks ago. It's super easy process. It comes directly to you. You just, it's like swab it around your mouth. I mean, it's the easiest thing of all time. You put it in this cool purple liquid that like, keeps it and whatever. And then, you know, you guys do with it what you will at that point. 20 years down the road, what's this look like? What's health? What's wellness? Give me the wildest imagination. We're past RoboDocs at that point.
Yeah. And you haven't got your results yet. So I can't wait for you.
I have not got my results yet. I'm fired up.
Oh, that's pumped. Like for me, I'll answer your question. For me, athletically is where it made the biggest difference. So for example, I found at all these snips related to recovery, I needed more recovery than I was giving myself. Also had the collagen snip that I mentioned earlier, and I used to get all these tendon ligament injuries. And when I started massively increasing my collagen protein, those went away. Yeah. So some cool stuff that I think you'll find.
I can't wait. I'm such a nerd, so I cannot wait to get these back.
Yeah. I'm pumped for that.
Yeah.
In 20 years. So I think to talk about like where technology and science is moving in 20 years would be almost a fool's game because of this exponential curve on with AI. What I think is happening, again, if I had to like postulate in 20 years, what I see kind of the world moving towards, and this is a hopeful kind of optimistic thing, is much more of a, we talked about kind of being in our heads recently, and that's where we've been with medicine. I think we're moving more towards a feeling society and world, like where emotions and feelings, we're starting to realize and understand how critical they are. And what I'm hoping is like all the AI and all that offloads all this physical stuff. Like for me personally, I've been so deep in this. I feel like I'm squeezed out so much of what I can get on the optimization and the performance and maximizing my health span. And what I focus on now is different books. There's, you talk about mindset, like I love like on one hand, like the Jocko Willink, like extreme ownership stuff, but then also it's really the feeling stuff. My favorite book on leadership is the 15 Commandments of Conscious Leadership.
Okay.
Books around consciousness. There's a book called Awake by Angelo DeLullo.
Mm-hmm.
There's Byron Katie, her work, and really kind of feeling your feelings all the way through and your emotions, which 2 years ago, I would have vomited just talking about it or like.
Same.
But I think that's the next evolution for me. And so maybe it's a very egocentric thing to think of. But when I look around in the world, I see people starting to realize how much more important that is than probably their vitamin D level. These other things. So that's where I hope we are in 20 years is really talking about and the connection stuff and the connection. What I'm talking about now is the connection to ourself when I talk about those feelings and emotions.
Dr. Matt Dawson, absolutely fantastic show today. You exceeded my expectations and they were quite high coming in because Wild Health is truly transcending what is going on with longevity, anti-aging, fascinating stuff. Really cool. Really appreciate you taking out the time. People, all the information on Wild Health is going to be in the show notes. Is there anything other than plugging people directly to the website that you want people to go to right now?
I think this is wildhealth.com is where everything is. And I got to say, it was a lot of fun, incredible questions. Like I really enjoyed the time. Thanks so much.
Good. Yeah. Thanks. I look forward to connecting further and getting my results back. I'll give them to the podcast. Maybe we can get you back on and we can chat about my results and like optimization and stuff. That could be a cool show. But awesome. Thanks so much. Grow or Die fam. We appreciate y'all. Make sure to share us, support Wild Health. We'll see y'all next time. Peace.